I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. It really feels like fall in this town when the Writers' Fest kicks off, and very shortly the 30th edition will begin. Since 2005, Hal Wake has been its artistic director, and last year he announced it would be his last. He joins me now, as he has for a number of years around this time of year, to preview what's to come. We'll also reflect on these stellar years where the festival has just grown in attendance, sales, and the number of world-class authors coming to Vancouver and filling Granville Island with readers, a special week in October. Visit writersfest.bc.ca this year. There are well over 100 authors and nearly 100 events, and it's all set to begin the 16th of October through to the 22nd. There are, as expected, a number of sellouts already, so we'll look to Hal to tell us what's to look forward to before becoming the artistic director of the Writers' Fest. Hal Wake had a distinguished career at the CBC, first producing on Peter Zosky's Morningside, and then hosting the morning program Early Edition here in Vancouver until 1997. He trained as an actor and stage manager at Carlton. I'm very pleased to welcome back to the Plant Online program Hal Wake. Good morning, Mr. Wake.
Good morning.
The stage manager and actor.
I'm laughing at that because, God damn it, it just is proof that, and I'm sorry I swore.
No, that's fine.
It is proof that you just can't get rid of stuff on the
on the internet.
Yeah, it was a friend of mine who was putting together a bio, and he made it up out of his head about stuff I told him and other things that he kind of invented, and it sits out there with some real falsehoods in it, which I'm scared about because somebody's going to say, oh, you said that you did this and you didn't. The stage managing, I did perform a little bit, and I did help out with university productions, and I did want to be an actor because I've never experienced anything like being on stage involved in a production when something's cooking and you can feel between the audience and the people on the stage like the electrons in the moving. It's nothing like it. But you have to be talented, and I gave that up real fast.
And there are many times in your time at the Writers' Fest and even in other events where you're talking with authors and there's an audience involved, where you feel that, don't you? I mean, you've got to feel that, because, I mean, I've sat in at Writers' Fest events over the years, and there's a real, I would assume, charge.
There can be.
On the stage there from the conversation, and not only the conversation, but from the reaction from the audience.
Yeah, there are very special ones where there's either we've set out to create an emotional atmosphere, not manipulatively, but because the books and the material demands it. And then there are other times where it just sort of creeps in. You don't expect it. Although in terms as an interviewer, I prefer this kind of thing, or where we're face to face and there is no audience, or even better, I like it when I can't see the person I'm interviewing. And the reason is because I can concentrate just on what they're saying, the tone of voice. The minute you get an audience involved, the dynamics shift.
Yeah. Sheila Rogers said that that's her favorite kind of interview because she's in the place of the listener.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
yeah.
And I've been doing this for a while.
Often do it. I mean, we usually do this on the phone. Yeah.
Yeah. And I find that people will tell you things over the phone that they wouldn't tell you otherwise.
That's probably true too.
Yeah. We're less than a week before the festival starts. Are there events that are sold out? I mentioned that in the introduction, that usually when we talk, there are things that are already unavailable.
Yeah, I'm going to guess something like 15, some of which would be events primarily of interest to student groups.
Yeah.
Although, we've got this fabulous young science whiz, Britt Ray, who's done a book on the ethics and of bringing extinct species back to life. An incredible story. I mean, it's nonfiction, and she's in Denmark now, although she's Canadian. That event sold out. That would be of interest, of course, to just about anybody. It sure was of interest to me. Yeah. So about 15, I would say. But then sometimes tickets suddenly come available, and as soon as they do, we put them online for people to...
Yeah, and so that's why it's important for people to check the website.
Absolutely, and phone the box office, because who knows, you know? Phone the box office, and sometimes we keep waiting lists for some events, because we sometimes will throw on an extra one. I don't know that we'll do that this year, but...
And that speaks to the real community part of it, because it's not only the folks that you hang out with in terms of publishing and the writers and the business part of it, but... It's the readers, too. I mean, that's a very important part. I mean, it's such a community here where, there's such encouragement between both readers and writers, and you really feel that on Granville Island that week of the festival.
I am so glad that you used the word community, because that's exactly what we have been trying to build all along, is... to bring readers and writers together to talk about ideas and build a community of, or gather really a community of readers. And the festival has grown almost by half again since I started, not willy-nilly, not because we just wanted to get bigger, but in response to demand. And so when the community, as you put it, says, we like this. We want to go hear writers. We care about books. And we want more. Then we've grown. One of the things that I hear from writers from around the world, over and over and over again, is their astonishment at the quality of the audience's size. They really love, of course, being in front of a sold out house. But then it's the, and we're back to the atmosphere in the room, the kinds of questions that are asked, the sense that people are treating this seriously. You know, they're not, you don't hear a lot of where do your ideas come from kind of question, because these are people who have read the books or read the author and come wanting to engage in a discussion.
Yeah, I've talked to a lot of writers who come through town for the festival, especially the ones from out of town. They say from the minute that they're picked up at the airport by your volunteers through to meeting the people at the venue and the readers especially, just how special it is and how they just can't wait to come back year after year whenever they have a book out.
We have Miley Malloy coming this year, and I would recommend that people check Miley out. It's spelled M-A-I-L-E, but pronounced Miley. She's of Irish descent, and she sent me, she's an American, and she's just an unbelievable writer. And she sent me a note after one of her visits, and she said that her husband had asked her, because he comes with her frequently, and he said, why can't we go every year? And she said, well, I have to write a book. And he said, write faster. So she is back this year, and I think he'll be happy.
And so in the 12 years that you've been at the helm of this thing, you've had writers come frequently. And that's the other thing. There's a great relationship between some of the writers. And I'm not just talking about Alistair MacLeod and Alice Munro and those sorts of folks. But you've seen writers grow, haven't you, in terms of they come here for their first book, say, and then they're back for their second or third.
Absolutely. If we didn't have to sell tickets, and we do because, public funding is great, and we have sponsorship, and we have members, and we go out, and we get donations, personal donations, but ultimately you want box office to some degree, and you need that revenue stream. And we also rely upon publishers to send the writers to us. So the festival is shaped to some degree by who's available.
What the season is, right?
Yeah. Well, it'll be spring or fall, yeah. And there'll be a promotional budget attached to a book, and the publishers will say, you know, we'd love to send you A, B, and C. And then, you know, we end up with, maybe 300 names to choose 100. So it's not like we need a hell of a lot more to choose from. But the point I'm getting at is that it might be a very different festival if we were totally unfettered to choose whomever we want. So yeah. Sometimes there's a returning author whom we've invited back because we love them, we know their good value, that they'll do a fabulous job, and because their name will bring some people in. And then what we can do is put that first-time author that you're talking about into an event. So Durga Chubose is an example of that this year. She's written a first collection of essays. It got great reviews and everything, but, I mean, she's not exactly a household name. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we put her with Adam Gopnik and Andrew O'Hagan, and people will come. I mean, Gopnik, almost everything he's in is sold out, yeah. Not quite. And they'll discover her,
yeah.
And that's fantastic.
Yeah. That's the other thing that I've loved about the festival over the years, are these panels that are put together with, say, established authors, new authors, as well as people that you wouldn't think would go well together, but on stage it just clicks.
That's the crapshoot.
Yeah.
It's a bit like a chemical reaction, and I feel like a medieval alchemist, you know, with a pointed hat, and I'm kind of dropping a little bit of this, yeah. A little bit of that, and you're just hoping it doesn't blow up in your face, but yeah. you know, you don't know, and when it clicks, I guess a few years ago we had Tim Winton and Christos Solkus from Australia with Matthew, and I'm going to lose his last name, from the U.S., an American novelist with his first novel, which got a whole lot of attention. And the focus of the discussion was basically how to be a good man, which I think most men who are at all sensitive to the world around them, you know, have to ponder what is our changing role and place in the world, and how do we fulfill the best of what we should be doing. And I remember watching a chunk of it, and Christos, who wrote a book called The Slap, which got a lot of attention, I think was made into a movie as well. But you could see him, and he was leaning forward with his elbows on his knees and his hands covering his face. And I thought, oh, my God, he's having a hideous time. You know, how can we salvage this? Which, of course, you can't do once it's underway. But I was misreading him entirely, because when somebody finished talking, his head would come up and he would just leap in with something. And the chemistry of that group just took off, and they it was a sort of siloed discussion, and normally I don't like one person talking, another person talking, but man, it just clicked, and you don't know.
Yeah.
You honestly don't know.
And then I'm sure there are times where people are sitting in the audience, and I mean, this has happened to me, where I wish it was longer, you know, and the panelists, you know, wish it was longer as well.
Well, for me, those are the events where you can literally see an idea being born. Somebody says something, and you look over, and one of the other writers is thinking about it, and you can tell that they're thinking about it. And then they say something, and you really suspect that that's probably the first time they've said that in quite that way.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and you get this back and forth of people thinking on their feet. And you realize that there's something being built here that will never, if you're not there, never happen again. Those people will never be in the same room, likely. And that's such a privilege when you walk out the door and go, I witnessed something remarkable.
So I'm sure you've been asked this a lot over the last year, so why are you leaving?
Yeah, I guess I've been asked. 12 years is a good run. I am old enough that I hope I have one, maybe two more things, new things to do. And if I don't get started on it, I'll probably just go to bed and go to sleep, you know. So this is the right time for me to try to see if I can do something a little scary.
And as someone who's worked with writers as you have over the years, and you've interviewed them before you had this job, do you think you'll ever try writing yourself?
I get to ask that question a whole lot. I doubt it. I'm not sure I have anything to say. I don't have a good memory, so I've seen and heard a lot of great stuff, but I can't remember most of it, and I didn't take notes. I mean, working at Morningside was with Peter Zosky was an incredible experience. But, yeah, so, and the last part of it is that I've just seen so many great writers. I understand what the hard work that's involved. Yeah. I used to say I didn't write because I didn't have, hadn't found my own voice, which is true. I don't have a written voice. I feel comfortable when I talk about that, that who I am is coming through. I don't feel that when I write. And then I realized that one of the reasons I don't have a written voice is because it doesn't descend magically upon your shoulders. You write and write and write and write, and that's how you get your voice, and that's daunting to me.
And that's the amazing thing about talking to authors, and I'm sure you've felt this over the years, is just how much hard work it is, isn't it? And it is a crapshoot of a business, isn't it? Because if that book doesn't do well, you may not get a second book.
It's filled with self-doubt, dry spells. I would say particularly if you're setting out to do something challenging that you know is going to push the boundaries. And I think for a lot of writers, they're like musicians, you know, their fans expect the same thing or something similar. Mm-hmm. And if you decide, I'm going a different direction here. I want to extend my craft. And the best writers that I've spoken to are always looking to push themselves farther, to take on something that they're not sure that they can do. So built into that is a tremendous amount of fear, it seems to me. Exhilaration, but you're taking risks.
The sensitivity that you have towards the process of writing and say, promoting or supporting the writer, did that come from your years on the radio with Zosky? Because, I mean, authors I've talked to over the years have said just how remarkable it was once they got on that Morningside show, what it meant for not only sales but for their stature and the encouragement that they got from him personally. For their careers.
Yeah, certainly we knew that by having somebody on the program it could establish them or bring attention. And the ones I liked the most were interviews where it was a book that absolutely almost nobody would have picked up. So I remember being sent, as you're often sent, books from a publisher. And this book was called The Diaries of Henriette Dessau. I can't remember who the publisher was. And Henriette Dessau was a 15-year-old Quebecois Catholic girl in the 1700s, early 1800s. And she kept a diary. And the life that was in that diary, the things she talked about, the insight we as readers got into that time period and that place It was amazing. Of course, she was not available for an interview, but we talked to the editor, and to have brought attention to that book, felt fabulous, because it should have been read. It needed to be read.
And when you worked at Morningside, were you here in Vancouver or were you in Toronto?
Mostly in Toronto. One year I worked from out here. I wanted to come home, yeah, as it were. I'm originally from Ottawa, but Vancouver had become home, and certainly my family wanted to come back. So I did 1 year from here.
Yeah, and I've talked to people over the years that worked with Zosky. I mean, there's such reverence of him from listeners, from someone who's worked close with him over the years. I mean, he called you the Wayne Gretzky of producers at one point. I've asked you this before, but I'll ask you again.
And now I want to be the Connor McDavid of producers.
There you go, yeah. What was that like? What were those years with Zosky like? And I mean, he must have taught you a great deal, not just maybe telling you stuff, but I mean, you just learn from working next to someone.
Yeah, it was mostly not direct instruction. It was observation, and it was over a wide range of things. I hesitate to call myself, or certainly I did back then, a journalist, because I'm not sure I had quite the credentials to be a journalist. I was a book producer who also did current affairs and did pull together significant discussions on important public issues. So the first thing that I learned was the notion of focus. And I still use it to this day. And when I witness conversations, discussions, interviews that are unfocused, it drives me absolutely insane. I need, and I think the listener needs to have a sense of what this is about, and a sense that it's moving, that the conversation is moving in some particular direction towards some resolution, or at least some major point. So the whole question of focus. Peter taught me that that it's the listener that is the most important part of the equation. That it was amazing to me. He read every single letter that came into the program, demanded that he open it first. And normally in radio, people protect hosts. Mm. They don't want them to actually look at the mail unvarnished, because there's some pretty vile stuff. Nothing compared to what happens on the internet now. Yeah. But back then, if you opened a letter, you could easily get a pretty unflattering picture of yourself. But he demanded to see the mail first. And the reason was, he wanted to get a sense of what people were thinking, how they were reacting, if they were reacting. If the mail, listener mail, went down, he'd come into a meeting and he'd say, "We're not reaching people. We're not striking a chord. We've got to do something and find material that people want to respond to." So that whole that notion. And then, sitting across when he was doing interviews, I learned an immense amount. But, the most important thing, and it is very simple, which is listen. Listen to what people are saying and think about it. His questions often would be long and convoluted, and he had critics who said, "God, he bumbles his way through a question." And I would go, "It's because he's thinking."
Yeah.
It's because he doesn't exactly know what he wants to ask until he gets it out.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing. Anybody can read a goddamn question.
Yeah.
That's not brilliance.
Yeah. And he made it look so easy. Or made it sound so easy, I should say.
Yep.
And I think that's the gift of a good conversationalist. At one point, you realize that I'm sure there's a piece of paper in front of him or papers in front of him, but it doesn't sound like it.
No, see, what, and that was there were 8 or 10 of us who were producers in the sense of writing scripts on a daily basis, or every bunch of interviews a week. And I don't think our work should be undervalued. We did research. When I was an author, I would read the book. I would think very carefully about what I thought was important that we should get into. So he had all of that. The genius was that he absorbed it.
Mm.
And then when a question was asked, it sounded like it was coming. Might have been my question. Might have been, but it came out of, it was connected to an experience of his or a thought of it. So it sounded like it was him. And that was genius. And that's why it sounded easy. It's like, oh, this guy's just sitting there gabbing away.
Yeah.
There was a machine back there, but people didn't see it.
Was he the best there was in this country?
I would never say, I wouldn't try to evaluate. Because every, sort of like hockey players, baseball players, different strengths, different kind of approaches. I had immense respect for Barbara Frum, and Barbara could do a tough interview in a way that Peter never could, because Peter hated confrontation. And Barbara Frum was just always so calm, unflappable, as she was nailing somebody to the wall,
yeah,
with facts, logic, argumentation. So there have been and continue to be. I mean, sad to say, but I think at times Gian Gomeshi was a good interviewer, and I say sad to say because it seems for all intents and purposes that's been thrown away and wasted. And
it's also been debunked, too. I think people say that it wasn't all him, that a lot of those producers had a lot more, especially in his writing, I should say, not just in the conversation, but his writing especially, I think.
Well, yeah, that opening essay,
which we all thought was riveting
like,
stuff,
and
unfortunately was not. But no, you're right, as a conversationalist, I think.
And the big mistake there is, I think you just should be transparent, If somebody else is going to write it, deliver it, but credit who wrote it, Let's not play around.
But you're right, as an interviewer, there are people that I know who hadn't listened to public radio or radio in general and listened to that show and were drawn to him as an interviewer because he was interested.
Yes.
In
genuinely curious.
In the person he was talking to. Do you miss broadcasting yourself? I mean, I know you get to talk to people from time to time did you miss being in front of...
When are you going to ask me what I'm going to do next?
What are you going to do next?
I'm going to do a podcast.
Are you? You'd be marvelous.
One of my favorite very recent New Yorker cartoons, I've been telling a lot of people, because I have been musing aloud about a podcast, but this is a cartoon with a man and a woman, and they've each got a cup of coffee, and they're sitting outdoors at a cafe, and she's kind of musing, and she goes, "I'm thinking of not doing a podcast." I thought, zing. Do I miss? Yes, because and you understand and enjoy the pleasures of this, not necessarily in this particular interview, but when you are a curious person, when you do care about a lot of things, when you get a chance to talk to somebody who's got something interesting to say, you've got a passport, right, to travel the world, and
you get to talk to people that you wouldn't otherwise talk to, right?
Yeah, you got a license that says you can go and do all this stuff. So, I certainly do miss that. But
so, will you do a podcast?
I don't know. It looks hard. I have to pay for lessons. things have changed a lot since since I was in the radio business. But I'm open to all kinds of ideas. I just haven't had the time. I've been so focused on this particular festival, which I should mention before you kick me out of here. I think that it's as good a lineup of writers as we've ever had. The diversity of material and topics from and there's some sort of hidden gems in here. Sandra Perron, who is became the highest ranking woman in the Canadian Armed Services, has written a memoir which is both utterly harrowing in terms of what she experienced in the military, but also redeeming in terms of the contribution she was able to make and the trail she was able to blaze. So we have Sandra, we have Ken Dryden, who's actually an old friend. You haven't heard much about this book because the publisher's keeping it very much under wraps. But we have him at the festival, and he's going to do nothing less than try to change the way organized sports, but mostly hockey, handles concussions. And he's going to take on the NHL until they change.
He talks about one particular player.
He does.
I'm trying to find the book.
Steve Montador. If you have a copy of the book, you are very lucky because there are very few out there in circulation. It'll be everywhere in a week. But it's not just nonfiction. I mentioned Miley Malloy and John McGregor from the UK, who won the Impact Prize, was long listed for a Booker this year, and has been long listed for the Booker before. Just a fabulous writer. They're in a couple of events together, and I would highly encourage people to check them out. So there's something, and then there's we have a night of young women designed to be filled with drinks and fun and true confessions. We have a marvelous event that where Leanne Dunich has written a book. We gave the book to a collective of artists who've each done a work of art, painting, sculpture, installation, based on their encounter with the book. And on that evening, we'll hear from Leanne, and then we'll hear from the artists. And then Leanne also happens to be a great musician, so we'll just turn it into a rock music night. I don't think anybody does something like that. Take advantage of it.
What's also struck me about the guests that you bring into town, and this happens not only this year but year after year, just how timely certain things can be. And these are pretty tumultuous times politically, and the future is certainly uncertain. And you have people talking about important things like climate change, about the environment.
Refugees.
And the political situation. I'm sure when you have Gopnik in town, I'm sure he'll have a thing or two to say about Trump.
Yeah.
And that's happened year after year, hasn't it, over the 30 years, that there's always the times, I guess, bring people to the island with conversation and important subjects that need to be discussed.
Well, and let me add one more from this year, which is three Indigenous people, writers, one from New Zealand, one from Australia, and one from Canada, because we've done reconciliation. We've looked at various aspects of the Canadian issue, and this was an opportunity for us to say, what's happening in Australia and New Zealand compared to Canada, and who's got good ideas, and who's making progress, and what can we learn from each other. So I think that's a really important discussion. But you're right, and it goes back to our methodology. And when I say our, I have to give incredible credit to Clea Young, who has worked beside me almost the whole time that I've been at the festival, and who's grown into, I mean, you know, she's inside my head half the time, knowing what I think before I think it. But there are programmers and at festivals in the country who just leap immediately on a bunch of writers and kind of cherry pick something that's bright and shiny. And as hard as it is, we wait until we have almost everything in front of us, and then we say, aha, this book works with this book. This is a conversation that appears to be timely. This year, lot of essays. We wouldn't have known that except we waited, and all of a sudden there they were, all of these brilliant essayists, and we'd never seen a kind of proliferation of that before. So it's patience and then finding the things that are speaking to whatever is going on at the moment, as you say.
And it's a year-long job, isn't it? I mean, people will assume that you start, say, well, maybe a couple weeks in, you know, before,
yeah.
And then you put the... But no, it's no. You're looking for things. You know?
Oh, yeah.
And so what's that like now with your successor? Well, I guess she's been in the book business before.
She
grew up in the book business with
her dad.
Yeah. And she's worked with you when she was on the board for a number of years, right?
That's
so she knows this festival quite well.
Yeah.
I mean, is it really the case, as you've said over the years, it's a year-long thing, but she's thinking about next year already?
Probably she may. She officially started last Monday, so we're very much in the throes of handling the little bits of thread that have come loose and need to be stitched back. For this festival, but she may have all kinds of ideas. We'll take a month together to talk about, and all I can do is really say, here's the approach that we took, that I took, and take what you want out of it, and any new ideas I think would be fabulous. Because, you know, I just do what I do, and somebody else can do something very different and very exciting.
What's the thread between her, you, and say, Almalee, who founded this thing 30 years ago? What's at the core of this festival and makes it so unique and so special compared to, say, other literary events in this country?
You've actually touched on it a couple of times already. We treat the writers, we believe that the writers, that are a main part of our job is to give the writers the best possible experience from the minute they get picked up, as you said, at the airport till the time they leave. That includes on stage and off. And we are devoted and dedicated to the audience and to seeing that they are served as well as we can possibly serve them. There's a lot of work that goes on after that and underneath that, but that's the simple formula. If your audiences are happy and satisfied, they come back. And if the writers have a great time, you get a reputation and you're able to bring those groups together and create amazing conversations. That's the secret.
One of the great things for people listening to us who might not, who've never been to the festival, is you not only get to see a conversation with the author on stage, but very often, more often than not, they stick around and will sign books.
Absolutely.
And people can buy books there. And I read a figure, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, it's about $100,000 in sales last year?
You'll be right, yeah.
And that's 1 week, right?
Yeah, we're aiming at 110 this year. Because Kids Books, Vancouver Kids Books, our bookseller, they're just ferocious about making sure that they have ordered properly. You know, at the heart of it, you know, we create the conversations, we have a good time, everybody. But if books aren't sold, this is not sustainable. And writers keep writing when their books are sold, publishers keep publishing, and then we're in business. So, and also, as you know, I mean, I'm sitting in a room, I'm going to blow your cover right here, right now, surrounded by books, and some of them I can tell are 20, 30, maybe even more years old. I recognize the titles. A lot of them are political and Canadian history, but they're treasures, and they're hard to part with. And if people buy books and get it signed, it's reflective. Not you have a book, but you also have an experience.
Yeah, and you know, there's a tremendous upheaval in the media. The book publishing industry has changed. It's contracted. It's gone all over the place in the last 12 years or so. But when I hear that figure of $100,000 in sales, I mean, you know, it's not as bad as
like
people.
Second Christmas.
You know, yeah, it's not as bad as people, you know, would say that the business, you know, that it's down the tubes or anything like that, right?
And it's so exciting to see a writer who maybe isn't a household name in an event, and they read brilliantly, or they're hilarious, or they're moving and poignant, you know, whatever it is, and then you just watch people get up and walk back to the bookstore and grab that book,
yeah.
Because they want to live that experience again. So, yeah, the people are buying. Yeah.
And that's the encouraging thing. People that means people are reading as well. And they're reading real books, not electronic ones, right?
I actually don't care how people read, and I think that we tend to forget, because the book has been with us for so long, that it's a technology. You know, it took something that was oral or written down on scrolls and whatever, and put it into a mechanically reproducible form. That's what a book is. That's technology. The digital revolution is with us and going to change things. But the important thing is that people keep telling stories. That it's the narrative. And I don't think that can go away, because it's how we understand and explain the world to each other, is through story and narrative.
And you're hopeful, as I am, that 30 years from now the Writers' Fest will still be around, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I won't be 30.
You know, I'm sure you're asked this all the time about, say, your favorite book, or a book that you've enjoyed, or a writer that you like. Having had this job, as you have over the last 12 years, have you found, say, experiences that you've had with the authors themselves? Has that added to, say, what you've liked? And I mean, I'm sure there's a book that you like from when you were a kid, or when you were young, you know, in school or something like that. But I'm sure, having met so many authors and so many good authors, and read so many good books over the last 12 years since you've had this job, have any of those had a resonance in your life?
I have a curious and annoying habit, which you may have noticed or not noticed, of going far away from the actual question and backing into an answer, you know, eventually getting to the question that was asked. And but I think I do that partly because it's a way of providing context. So the context here is that the festival has to some degree diminished my reading. It seems, you know, just contrary to logic, but I read snippets a lot now, because I'm just trying to grab things here and there, and that the only really close, sustained reading I can manage is with people I'm going to interview, and you know, there aren't that many. So I'm looking forward to returning to a point where I can pick a book up and just, you know, hammer through to the end. In terms of experiences with writers, it's been an immense gift. The opportunity to have conversations informal, in the hospitality suite. There are, and I now have friendships with writers around the world, and you know, they subside over time. You know, if you don't see somebody for 3 or 4 or 5 years, you're obviously not as close. But Sarah Dinant is coming this year, and yeah, I first met Sarah probably 12 years ago. And it's been an enduring friendship, even though, again, we don't see each other all that often. And there are many other writers like that, and there's some Canadian writers, obviously, who I crisscross with all over the place. But I feel very much a part of a community because of that, and those experiences that you're talking about when you late at night are sharing things with smart folks. It's a great privilege.
What's it like, though? I mean, because you probably read Alice Munro or Alistair MacLeod before you got to meet them. Mm-hmm. And I know those. I mentioned those two in particular because you had very, very special relationships with them over the years, and it connected with this festival. They were obviously good experiences, memorable ones, and remarkable ones. Does that change how you look at their work?
I would say no. No. I think that the marvelous thing about reading is that for all intents and purposes, a book does not exist unless somebody reads it. It's the old tree falling in the forest. I mean, you could write a book. If nobody reads it, what is it? It's your words sitting somewhere. The minute a reader sits down and opens that book and starts into it, now you've got a live, organic experience. And you and I read the same book. It's a different experience for you as it is for me. I'm responding to different things. I'm bringing who I am, where I am in my life, and you are doing the same thing. So the fact that I may know a writer, I think what I hear a lot from people who come to the festival, and I do believe this completely, they say when they hear a writer reading it, that voice is in their head. And when they go back and read a book, they hear that voice. And that is true. That, you know, whether it's an accent, whether it's an intonation, whether it's you bring the voice back with you. And that makes it, I think, a little richer experience.
Yeah, there's some, like, I think of Allie Smith, for example, who I'd never read before. Until I saw her at a panel. She was with other authors that I was there to see.
Boy, you were lucky because, you know, I tried for years. I tried again this year to get Allie. And in the end, we had her in the brunch, I think, on Sunday, and then on a panel discussion Sunday night. And that is the only time she's been here.
Yeah. And so I mean, after seeing her on stage, and I mean, she's just such a wonderful personality. That, I mean, it's drawn me to her writing. And you're right. I mean, that's the voice that I read now.
I mean, if you'll forgive me, a quick anecdote. I've been trying for years to get Allie and developed. We had a bit of a correspondence, which was far more familiar than should happen between people who've never met.
Yeah.
But she's just so open and wonderful. And finally, we got her here, and I thank the Giller Prize. She was on the Giller jury that year, and they brought her over a little bit early, and we were able to piggyback and get her at the festival. And I came into the theater, and she was sitting at the author's table with her back to me, and we had never met. And she's tiny, like, and she's 5-something, 2 or... And I just went up, and I put my hands on her shoulders, and she didn't turn. And I said, Allie, it's Hal. And she turned around, and she jumped up on the chair, which brought her just about to the same height as me, and gave me this huge hug. And that's another thing, you know. I mean, just that sense that you're connected to to a genius. I mean, Allie is one of the greatest writers of our time, and she's shortlisted for the Booker this year, and I'd love to see her win.
Yeah. And speaking of prizes, the Giller finalists, they'll be here?
Yes, I believe that Rachel Cusk has previous commitments and won't be. Rachel was shortlisted not last year, but the year before that. British novelist who, in order to qualify, and was born in Canada, certainly has Canadian citizenship. But I don't think she'll make it, but the other four will be on stage, yeah.
And that, again, that goes to the timeliness of it, that you're able to have people who are at the fore of their field.
And a very surprising list this year. I mean, a lot of the people you might normally expect to be on there weren't. So a lot of the prizes, in fact, if you look at the Governor General's Award, the Writers Trust, the Writers...
The Fiction Prize.
Yeah, Rogers Writers Trust Fiction Prize. Those three lists, there's almost no overlap, and there are some books that people wouldn't have heard of, and now will, which I think is a great thing.
Yeah, because I know you've served on juries in the past. I mean, what's that process in terms of as you program a festival and you see sort of the political stuff that goes on? And I mean, it's not overtly political, but I mean, you know, there's a lot of, you know, talk about, oh, what was nominated, what wasn't nominated. And then you run into these people or you encounter these people as you know, you go to other festivals, and especially in this town during the Vancouver edition. It's still a business, though, isn't it?
It is. I am of two minds about prizes, because the Giller Prize has done so much to bring attention to Canadian books, to reward Canadian writers, to the example I like to use a lot, because she's a friend that I admire immensely, is Liz Hay. Mm-hmm. You know, Liz would have been considered totally mid-list, you know, not well-known. She wins the Giller. Everybody reads that book. Then they go back and read the other books. Then they read every book that comes out after and realize this is one of our great writers. But, you know, so the other side of that is that every year there are going to be 10 or 15 writers like that who don't get the prize, that prize, or another prize. And I'm really kind of conflicted and at sea about how we bring attention to good books without relying completely on prize lists. And maybe that's part of my mission going forward, is to try to ring a bell and get attention and for books and writers that I think people really should know about. And that was a function that Morningside did on the radio. But I think we have to do a better job of it, because you can't expect one prize to carry the load. And juries are political. I mean, you get in that room, and there are trade-offs, you know. That's just a fact. I don't think we've figured out the jury system either, to be honest.
And then you get chatter online about, you know, when they would say one body appoints a jury. Well, the criticism about who's on the jury and whether they should be on the jury, that happens online right off the bat, right?
Well, juries are often not announced till later. I mean, yeah. I guess with the Giller, they do. They do announce the jury before they get into it.
I remember there was one year where they were saying, well, there are no Canadians on this jury.
There's a good balance, I think, now. I think they are up to five jurors.
Yeah.
And and there's international representation, which gives you that
perspective.
Yeah, that outside objective. I don't know these writers from a hole in the ground. I'm dealing with the book, but then you also have the Canadians who bring a familiarity and a knowledge about our literature.
So when people look you up online, they'll find out the Carleton University connection from the past. Yes. And then they'll find out that you hosted Early Edition.
Yes.
Until 1997. Yes. And then you went off to do other things and then eventually ended up at the Writers' Fest. How long did you host that show?
The Early Edition.
Yeah, because you can't find online.
94 to 97.
I see. And so
3 years.
And so
Rick Clough has done it ever since.
Ever since, yeah. You obviously became a morning person having done that job.
It's not morning. You get up. I got up at 3:45. That's not morning. That's the middle of the night. And no, I never. I did it. You did it. Because you had to do it, but it's nuts. And I believe that it can shorten your life.
Really?
Well, the thing is that it's not just that you're getting up then. It's that by 6 o'clock in the morning, I had to be ready to open my mouth and sound totally alive. And there were frequently I would just sit there for 3 minutes before the mic went on, just kind of deep breathing, gearing up, because you just go. And then for 3 hours, you're on. Then you go to a meeting to plan the next day's show. And if you think that you come down from that in an hour, you don't. I mean, you're still kind of pumping adrenaline. And I don't think adrenaline, it's a useful drug, but it's not a, you shouldn't be on it all the time.
Long term, yeah, I bet. The other thing that I've always wanted to ask is, why did you leave the CBC after the, as I mentioned in the introduction, a distinguished career at Morningside, and then you were hosting Early Edition?
Mm. Well, I'd done some great things. I'd been able to do things that pleased me and challenged me and allowed me to grow as a broadcaster, and I just looked down the road, and in particular the idea that I could do long form interviews like this, which is an immensely long form interview, I couldn't see that opportunity, and I just thought, okay, well, if I'm going to go, at least people know who I am now. As a producer, nobody knows who you are, but as a host, you know, then you've been in people's kitchens and cars and bedrooms for like up, 100,000 people or whatever it was, 5 days a week. Then, and I was able to build on that. So it was the right time.
And I guess, as you said earlier, this was the right time for you to leave the Writers' Fest.
It's all timing.
And when you look back at it from say 80 to now, 37 years. Well, nearly 40 years. I mean, you've been at the fore of the discourse in this town, in this country. What's that like when you take the time to think of take the wider perspective of it all and where we are in terms of the quality of our books and radio and our culture itself?
Wow. That is not a question I have been asked, and it is not a question I have thought about. I think I tend to be a person who is always looking, forward. What's next? What's on the horizon? What am I looking for? How do I get there? I don't look back. And maybe that's a function, too, as I said earlier, of having a terrible memory. So I could look back, but I wouldn't know
what to look back for.
But I think, I would answer your question by saying I fell into radio by luck, real luck. And I just discovered that it was a place where if you had a curiosity, you could indulge it. And then the festival has, in many ways, done that as well. And the other big thread throughout is building community, because I honestly believe that radio is about building community, and the festival is about building community. But I think that if you start to ponder the significance of that, or you know, dwell on, I'll go back and use the word significance. You can really get caught up in that, and it's been a real honor, and I've enjoyed it, and I don't think about what it means in larger terms, because I think it would be a little, maybe even a little scary to think about how lucky I've been to be in the middle of really interesting things.
Well, I'm tremendously lucky that you agreed to come in to do this, because we've run into each other over the years, but we've generally talked on the phone for the show. But to talk about this festival, the 30th Vancouver Writers Fest, and this tremendous lineup, and to talk about other things and to look back, you've indulged me a great deal, and I appreciate it.
Well, you know, there was something online. I think it might have started with Charlie Demers, the great comedian, writer, man about town here in Vancouver, who said on Facebook he couldn't understand why, for the life of him, Joseph Planta didn't have a regular spot on CBC or some major broadcaster, and there are a great many of us who feel exactly that way. So,
well, he's lying.
You do have a major spot.
No, he's lying. But he's very kind, and you're very kind to say that. I did see that, and but you know, I reflect back to it. I mean, it's a rough business now, isn't it? Than it was, say, 20 years ago.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the fact that you can do it yourself to some degree doesn't necessarily mean it isn't an advantageous thing to have the backing of a kind of an institution. But the hegemony of the broadcaster has broken down, and the ability of smart, thoughtful, curious people to do something and attract a listenership. That's growing, and that's a good thing.
Well, I appreciate it. Your very kind words, and you coming in to do this. Again, Al, to you and everyone at the Writers Fest, all good wishes.
Thank you.
And to you personally, congratulations for this amazing run.
It's been a joy.
And let's make sure our paths cross again, and I'm sure they will over the next few years, right?
I bet you. Yeah. I'll have you on my podcast.
There you go. Writersfest.bc.ca, and it's the 16th to the 22nd of October. And then, of course, there's Insight in the new year. They do tremendous work, and it's been such a pleasure to have Hal Wake here in person. I'm Joseph Planta.